This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Welcome to Heart and Soul with me, Lauren Booth, your place to reflect. Have you ever heard the saying, it's a dog-eat-dog world? Well, I'll tell you what, driving into Doha to work seems to prove that theory. I almost got forced off the road this morning. Yet this is also a realm, a reality of birth, love between parents and children, spouses and friends. In the scientific life, in the scientific light, it appears that we live in an ordered realm, but with a vast random aspect, which allows for cruelty and ultimately pointlessness. Joining me today to explore science through the eyes of Islamic understanding is Hamza Sorsis. Hamza is an international public speaker on Islam. He's an instructor for the Islamic Education and Research Academy in the UK, and his first book on Islam and atheism is due to be published later this year. I recommend his blog, which is full of great content, and is hamzasorsis.com. And if you can spell that, you'll be very blessed indeed. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Hamza.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, very well. I really wanted us to take a look at the unseen through the eyes of Islamic science, if that's a possible thing, because we live in an age where the two are said to be mutually exclusive. You work in this area, Hamza. How do you approach the two topics?
Well, it's a very, very, very massive topic to discuss. I'll try my best. I think the important thing to understand is we have to really know what science is, because many of us, even when we're studying science, we do not know the philosophical assumptions underpinning science. Now, I've specialized on a postgraduate level on science itself, the philosophy of science, and it was just amazing because it taught me that science is not the gospel truth, right? Science doesn't lead to certainty. If someone claims that science leads to certainty, then that's a very unscientific conclusion. And what we understood is, based on things like the problem of induction and other philosophical problems, that science will never lead to absolute truth. And sometimes we make a big mistake, and this is the mistake that's even echoed by the likes of Richard Dawkins and other academics and popularizers, where they think science leads to absolute truth because it works. Now, we first have to understand that just because something works, it doesn't mean it. True. Let me give you a quick example. Mm-hmm. In the 1700s, we had this theory called the theory of phlogiston. Now, it was an interesting theory. Basically, when things burned, or when they were burnt, they released something called phlogisticated air. Now, this theory was working, and Dan Rutherford in the 1770s, he used this workable theory, and he discovered the truth of nitrogen. But after a few years, they then found out that phlogiston was actually false. So what do we learn from this? Well, this is one example amongst many. What we learn from this is as follows, that you can get a truth from something that works that is based on a falsehood. And something could be working, but it may not be true at all. So we have to understand these principles before we start talking about religion and science, or before we start talking about science and Islam. Because you have to understand that they have two different kind of what you call epistemic foundations. Epistemic means the sources of knowledge, the study of knowledge. Now, and this is very interesting for us to understand, another key problem in the way we look at science is we have to understand that we always have limited observations. We're not going to see absolutely everything. We're never going to have an infinite number of observations, right? We're not God, right? In the Islamic tradition, we believe Allah is Al-Hakim. Al-Hakim means the wise. In a technical perspective, this means Allah, God, has the totality of wisdom and knowledge. in a very interesting saying, you could say that basically Allah has the picture, we just have the pixel. And this is extremely important because it gives us a sense of humility when we gain new knowledge. So coming back to the other problem, is that you never have all the observations at your disposal. You always have limited observations. Just like David Hume, the famous Scottish skeptic, and many other philosophers, they said that you can always have another observation that is at odds with your previous observations, so therefore your conclusions can always change. For example, if we look at the Big Bang, for example, many people think this is like gospel truth. You know, the Big Bang is a fact. In actual fact, it's not. If we study, forget the popular magazines, when we study in academia, we will see that there is some data, background radiation and all of these scientific pieces of data, but there are around 17 different models that explain the same data, and these models contradict one another. And what there is no kind of consensus of which model is best to explain the data. You have the oscillating model, the quantum fluctuation model, the Friedman-Lenard-Itray model, and all of these models. And the point I'm trying to say here is, isn't this the beautiful aspect of science, that it doesn't lead to absolutes? Isn't it beautiful to always be in this constant flux of learning and gaining new observations and having the humility of saying, you know what, even something works, it may not be true? And this leads to the whole debate of the realists and the anti-realists. Now, the realists argue that scientific theories are a representation of the state of affairs, meaning they represent truth. They mirror the reality. The anti-realists say, no, scientific theories, no matter how confirmed, they are just interesting models that explain reality, but they do not reflect the state of affairs.
Okay, so
Sorry for waffling on too much, by the way.
No, this is great. But let's bring us back to one. I want to propose this as a definite. Can something come from nothing? I mean, I remember as a, I'll tell you why I bring it up. I remember as a child lying in my bed, and my dad used to try and tell me to go to sleep, and he'd say, look, if you're not sleepy, just try and think of what is at the beginning of the universe and what is at the end of the universe. And I'd lie there and I'd try and fly backwards. And, you know, this concept of forever, whoa, you're just falling into nothingness. There has to be a start. And if you call it a bang, so what?
Well, there are two things here we have to understand. Based on what we've just mentioned so far about science and need to certainty, well, science can never even answer this question anyway, because it's a metaphysical question. And that's the problem with kind of modern-day science. Some popularizers, they blur the lines between philosophy, metaphysics, and science itself. I mean, by the very nature of the question, science can't answer it, because what you're basically saying is, you know, there is a state of nothingness, meaning something that is not observed, an absence of being, an absence of potential, an absence of anything. Now, that is a non-scientific reality, because science, according to Professor Elliot Sober, a mainstream philosopher of science, he says scientists can only deal with things that they can observe. Now, by the very definition of nothing, you can't observe nothing, right? So it's not even a scientific question. However, some scientists have tried to do linguistic gymnastics and play around with the word nothing. For example, they say nothing is an absence of time and space, but there is still something physical there. So if you change the meaning, yes, you could have a coherent model, like Professor Lawrence Krauss, who wrote a book, A Universe from Nothing, but his nothing, as he says, is something. Already confused? So am I.
Yeah.
So the point here is that he's just doing linguistic gymnastics, which is very interesting. It's, you know, nothing for anyone with common sense, even philosophically minded, means an absence of potential, an absence of being, it's non-being, it's an absence of absolutely anything. So from that perspective, science can't even do the question, so we have to rely on metaphysics or philosophy or just normal reason. And normal reason tells us that if you had, for example, zero, and you plus, and you had another zero, and you add another zero, all you're going to get is zero, right? And even conceptually, think about it. You have nothing, which is the absence of anything, no potential, and you add more nothing, and just add more nothing, you're still going to get nothing.
There is something I wanted to add here that I heard recently, which kind of blew my very unscientific mind, which is that in the sight of eternity and foreverness, everything that isn't forever is nothing, because it's so small. It's so small, it doesn't matter. So what I'm trying to say is we can't quantify our existence. There are things outside of the natural world. I mean, science was a system that was put together to try and measure things in a way that we could believe in. And that is a credible way of looking at the physical world. But then we have what philosophers have called the problem of consciousness, those whole metaphysical questions and feelings that are we here? Why am I in love? Why am I not in love?
Who is God? There's a lot here now. I mean, it's going to be probably very hard for the listener to basically jump around conceptually. So we started off by saying science will lead to certainty, that, you know, you have philosophical problems, but just because it works doesn't mean it's true. We have the problem of, you know, limited observations. You have the realists and anti-realists, and the philosophical discussion now has ended up by saying they both agree that scientific theories are defeasible, meaning they could be wrong. And then we start talking about, can something come from nothing? We said it's not a scientific question, it's a metaphysical question. Some scientists have tried to address it, but they have to change the meaning of nothing. And now we're moving on to consciousness, which is really one of my favorite topics. I wrote an essay for this in my postgrad. And this is a defeater against any type of what I call physicalist, materialist understanding of the world. Physicalism and materialism essentially means that you could reduce everything to physical processes.
Okay.
It doesn't mean you have to reduce it necessarily to pieces of matter, but you reduce it to physical processes and physical stuff. Now, what's very interesting about consciousness... Actually, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Mr. Lauren,
mm-hmm.
What is it like for you to wake up in the morning and have some English tea?
It's a happy place for me, English tea.
What does that mean? I want you to take that internal stuff that you're feeling when you're waking up in the morning having English tea, and I want you to give it to me. I want to experience exactly the way you experience having an English tea in the morning.
It is a comforting feeling because I like this. First, you smell it.
What does comforting mean for you? What's the internal experience of comforting for you?
Comforting. It's a place of safety and recognition, familiarity and a bit of nostalgia.
Good. What does all that mean, though?
It doesn't mean anything in the physical world. It only means something in my concept of reality.
Okay, great. So this is exactly what we're pinpointing here. What we've just exposed is something called the hard problem of consciousness. If you read the works of Professor David Chalmers, Professor Torin Alter, and many others, even Professor Thomas Nagel, when he wrote the famous 1970s paper,
mm-hmm.
Consciousness. Now, what's interesting here is you have a certain inner subjective experience. That's very first person. Now, the minute you start talking or try to put it in scientific language, it becomes third person in a way. I can't understand what you're going through.
Mm.
Internal, inner subjective experience that's unique to you. And this is the hard problem of consciousness. For example, what is it like for Sister Lauren to have a chocolate? Now,
why did you bring up chocolate? That's just rude. What you could have said cream cake. I mean, what are you hinting here?
I'm hinting anything.
I think that's a good place to take a break, Hamza. We'll be right back after the spoken word.
The hour is near. When the blessing is taken out of time, and it goes faster and faster, when earthquakes increase and natural disasters, when the weather becomes extreme, when Arabia turns green, when barefooted Bedouins compete in building buildings to the sky like Saudi, Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, and Dubai, when literacy increases but knowledge is lost, when the believers will be many but weaker than froth, when false prophets appear, know that the hour is near, though sometimes I get the feeling that it's already here. The last prophet sent to mankind told us about the signs that will happen on earth before the ending of time, when music is widespread and people wear it on their heads, when children are filled with rage, when the wife is respected and the mother is disobeyed, when the pious will disappear and trust will decrease, when people are intimate in public streets, when women will be dressed but appear to be naked, when the institution of marriage is no longer sacred when the liar is believed and the people are deceived and the worst of the worst are chosen to lead when the number of police begin to increase, when trials begin to appear in the east, when all the nations will gather against the believers. See, the hour has a face, and these are its features. When the one who is killed doesn't know the reason they had to die, and even the killer himself doesn't even know why, when nothing of Islam remains except for the names, and people abandon the religion for a worldly gain, when there is war between Muslims and Jews, when the speakers will be many and the scholars will be few, when the followers of Muhammad will be setting up rivals, praying to graves and worshiping idols, when people gather for congregation and no one prays with concentration, when the mosque will be lovely but the hearts will be ugly and lives will be ruined in the conquest for money, when interest will increase and there is so much credit and debt that no one would be able to avoid its effects. The signs are so clear that the hour is near, but sometimes I get the feeling that it's already here. When no one is able to make the Hajj, to visit the ancient mosque, when the believer wakes up and his faith has been lost, when the Antichrist appears, that one-eyed beast, when Gog and Magog come out from the east, when Jesus descends from the skies, dripping of pearls, then you know we have approached the end of this world. When the sun rises from the west and the pen has been lifted, there will be no repentance if you haven't submitted. These are not just events that the prophet predicted, because prophecies are promises that are already scripted. The last prophet sent to mankind told us about the signs that will happen on earth before the ending of time. The first will be his death, when he breathes his last breath. And it's been over 1400 years since he was laid to rest. But before he left, he told us about the end, what was written by the pen. He told us about Iraq, where the trials will begin. And we are living in the last days, holding on to hot coals, doing our best not to lose our souls. The minor signs have appeared, and the hour is near. But sometimes I get the feeling that it's already here.
Welcome back to Heart and Soul with me, Lauren Booth. Joining me today is Hamza Sorsis. And we were talking before the break about subjectivity.
Well, so coming back to the point, you know, chocolate is, now you've lost me. Right. Okay, that's it. I remember
subjective,
now.
Subjective,
so,
right?
Yeah, so words are vehicles to meaning, and meaning is a representation of the inner subjectivity. So that's one part of the hard problem of consciousness. The other part is, and as Professor Torin Alter says, why do we have inner subjective conscious awareness and feelings and experiences coming from non-conscious physical processes? These two points form what you call the hard problem of consciousness, and there is almost a consensus amongst materialists and non-materialists on the problem. And let me just repeat what the problem is. What is it like for a conscious being to have an inner subjective experience, and why do they have that inner subjective experience from physical processes? Now, this is what you call the hard problem of consciousness. Now, there have been some responses to Lauren. A response that we hear about is called eliminative materialism, which is, they say, look, why are you calling this the hard problem? Science and history has always had hard problems and they solved it, so what's the big deal? There is no such thing as internal consciousness, it's just an illusion, right? Mm-hmm. And this is interesting because even in the 1991, Dan Dennett, he wrote a book called Consciousness Explained, and he basically said, well, we don't really have internal experiences, they're just illusory. And you know, Professor Antti Ravonsio and others, they responded by saying, hold on a second, you're just explaining away what requires explaining. And that's why they said his book shouldn't have been called Consciousness Explained, it should have been called Consciousness Explained Away. So you have the eliminative materialists, but that's a false argument. Why? Because this is not about science catching up. We have to understand it's not a scientific question anymore. It's a metaphysical one. Meaning, can science, which deals with third-person facts, deal with first-person facts? No, you're de-sculpting the scientific method.
Okay, I'm going to bring it down to an example, and then we'll go to a break to give my brain a rest because this is such an incredible experience speaking with you. If you're a mother and you've given birth to a baby, and for some reason you have to be separated from that baby, and you're in another continent, and somebody shows you a picture of that baby, your milk is going to come down. And that is a physical reaction to a photograph. This is a feeling. Before we go to break.
Yeah, just to conclude what you're saying, to show that it's not a scientific question, if we were to map out your brain, for example, looking at that photograph, we would never be able to find out what it's like for you to see the photograph, because all we have is neurochemical patterns and firings in the brain. You can't derive from that your internal subjective feeling. This is why all science can do is look at these graphs and these correlations. Neuroscience is the science of correlations. You have these neurochemical firings. You can't make the logical leap now know what it's like for Sister Lauren to see a photo of her baby. This is impossible. Science is de-scoped, and that's why many philosophers and even scientists are saying this is not a scientific question anymore. This is a philosophical one. It's a rational one. And to be honest, this really points to the divine, which we could talk about after the break.
Thank you, Hamza. You'll be back with us after this incredible piece of spoken word.
My being yearns for the desert, for the stillness, the emptiness, the silence. Drowning me out of my mind, drowning inside, softly, slowly, know me. Face to face with my naked nothingness, in the name of his oneness, I bear witness that we are less than dust that dances with wind. Know us, just him. Know us, just him. Know us, just him. Lead me to a desert plain where nobody knows my name and nobody cares, busying their own hearts with the sacred art of calling the name from which all life came. Maybe I'll join this desert choir, attire nomadic, wrapped in 6 yards of fabric, protection from the sun's face and protection lest I forget that someday, when my soul meets with eternity, I'll be shrouded this way. Find me in some corner, weeping like a mourner, lamenting her lover, emptying my soul into the sand, emptying my heart into his hand until there are no bullets left in my chamber, until I have no choice but to surrender. Do with me what you will, Ya Rahman. I'm imagining a Maghrib sky, where the heavens have rose-tinted cheeks like a virgin bride, the scent of prayer perfuming the night, and when darkness arrives, we'll be cocooned in remembrance, and God's names will burst forth like butterflies to beautify the horizon. I'm daydreaming of the desert story, because London's lights are blinding me, and I'm listening out for God's voice, but the city screams so loudly, I can't hear myself. Breathe. I need some time away from a place where concrete competes with my Lord's artistry. Every part of me is yearning for the landscape that prophets would navigate, cloaked only in God's grace, enchanted only by God's face. Oh my days, what I would do for a taste of how it feels to be erased, to be able to say, Sakina doesn't live here anymore. All that's left is God's names.
That's all we have time for today. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give you a blessed evening and a safe drive home. More from me tomorrow. Thanks to my producer, Ihab Al-Sheikh. Assalamu alaikum. Allah.